You're listening to the Mind Over Murder podcast.
My name is Bill Thomas. I'm a writer, consulting producer, and now podcaster. I am now trying to use my experience as the brother of a murder victim to help other victims of violent crime. I'm working on a book on the unsolved Colonial Parkway murders, and I'm the co-administrator of the Colonial Parkway Murders Facebook group together with Kristen Dilley.
My name is Kristen Dilley. I'm a writer, a researcher, a teacher, and a victim's advocate, as well as the social media manager and co-administrator for the Colonial Parkway Murders Facebook page with my partner in crime, Bill Thomas. Welcome to Mind Over Murder. I'm Kristen Dilley.
That makes me Bill Thomas.
We're joined today with one of our very favorite guests, Colleen Fitzpatrick, here to talk to us about the boy in the box case. Colleen, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, hi. How are you guys doing?
We're good.
We are good. Okay. We were just comparing temperatures in Virginia, home of Kristen Dilley, Connecticut, home of Bill Thomas, and California. And what's the temperature in California, Colleen?
Right now it's a little nippy at 65, and we're all running to the closets for our winter clothing. It's freezing, and people in heavy coats and hats and muffs. It's not swimsuit weather, let's put it that way.
I used to love this time of year in Los Angeles. If it dipped below 55, let's say, at night, would you?
Oh, God.
People would have their parkas out and they'd be shivering and saying, it's so cold.
Yeah. It's 41 degrees here in Virginia, and I know you just got a blizzard up there, Bill. So what temperature is it in Norfolk, or dare we ask?
It's 22 degrees at the moment. Oh. And we're having more snow on the way.
Oh, God. I don't even think. And that means your house. Inside your house, you keep it at 65, and that's toasty to you.
When I came home, I had to run some errands. I came back, and my partner, Pamela, had just taught an online art class. And so I turned the heat down because her studio has its own special heat. So she came downstairs, and she said, did you just turn the heat back up? And I said, yeah, it was 62 in the dining room. And she said, I must be getting used to this because that felt pretty good.
Oh, it's cold. I was just sitting here with the heater on. I have a heater right by my feet. Now, we don't turn the heat on here anyway because the houses are not insulated.
Yeah.
So it costs beaucoup money to turn the heat on and have these little floor heaters where you can cheat a little bit.
And it's so cold in Southern California.
Oh, I'm telling you, it was actually 49 last night, and it was like, oh my God, are we going into an ice age? The whole global warming discussion starts turning on again.
Pamela wanted to know if Colleen was ever going to come and visit again. And I said, I hope she will, but I bet she won't come in February.
Yeah, I'll try and be out there. I'm out on the coast once or twice a year, out on the East Coast. I'd love to come by.
Speaking of the East Coast, Kristen and I have been talking about having you back for quite some time because we enjoy the conversation. And I certainly feel like I learn a lot when we talk with you about DNA and the work that you do. But we specifically wanted to ask you a little bit about the boy in the box case, which I know you've been working on for several years.
Sure.
So can you start just for anybody who's not aware, who hasn't been following this wonderful solve, can you tell us a little bit about the boy in the box case, just a little overview?
Yeah, I can, to get some dates out. The boy was found, I believe it was in February in 57. You can look that up on Wikipedia. He was found by, I believe it was somebody looking for squirrel traps or some kind of traps, and he was in a JCPenney bassinet box. So he was beaten. He was bruised up. He probably died of blunt force trauma to his head. At that time, Philadelphia, 1957, this was an unusual case. This was set the whole city on fire about how could the boy get there? What's going on with that? And some of the people nowadays that I've been in touch with and I worked with were actually about the same age the boy would be. So they told me that when they were young, they went with their parents to the grocery store to put up flyers to see if anybody recognized the boy and could identify his parents. I have to look up who did, but there was like 400,000 flyers sent out and also included in the electric bills to people to try and see if anybody would recognize him. And of course, nobody came forward, nobody said anything, and then the case went cold. If you look at what we had to work with in 57 compared to now, that it was very primitive technology, and that nothing could be done really except hope somebody would come forward. I think they tried to trace the JCPenney box, and they were able to trace some of them, but not all of them, and it went nowhere. I think there were 12 boxes sold, and that maybe they traced half of them or something like that.
And there were other pieces of evidence found that sounded promising. They found a man's cap nearby and some other things. They even traced the hat back to a store, and again, they had a description of the man who bought the hat. Everything seemed to lead to a dead end. There were people that came forward and said they thought they knew who the boy was. It's such a sad case. Mass media at the time, which would mostly been newspapers, they covered this case to a tremendous degree. People in Philadelphia remembered this case.
Yeah, it was one of those, it was that case that you hope would be solved, you know, that case. And of course, modern technology has advanced, and there was also a handkerchief with G on it.
Oh, yeah.
And that didn't go anywhere. He was wrapped in a blanket. They looked at that. There was really not too much evidence there that would lead anywhere. Over time, another thing they did was they photographed the boy sitting up in a chair, hoping he would look a little bit more natural, and nothing really went anywhere. As time went on, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, I believe Carl Koppelman, also did reconstructions of facial reconstructions or artist renditions of what he would look like. Then things just never happened. So about 1990, they exhumed his body for DNA. He was also transferred from the Potter Cemetery to Ivy Hill Cemetery, and the cemetery donated a really nice grave for him. That was about it. Nothing really panned out. The DNA that they got from 1998, that was, again, primitive analysis that went nowhere. It really wasn't anything. So the only really hope of identifying him would be genetic genealogy. I think everybody came to that conclusion. So that's how I got involved at one point.
How did you and Identifinders ultimately get involved? Did you get a phone call from somebody who said, my gosh, you just have to look at this case? Or was this always a wish list case for you?
It crept up on me because I had been in touch with the powers that be on that. I don't remember how I heard about it or got interested in it, probably about 2011, maybe even before that. And I was in touch with somebody named John Nemec, who was working the case or in charge of it, being a guardian of the case for NCMEC and probably for the VDOC Society. And I exchanged a few emails with him. I found out they had done mitochondrial DNA sometime in the past with mitotyping, and I traced the DNA being sent back to the Philadelphia Police Department. But that's about as far as it went. As far as mitochondrial DNA, they got some mito from the boy, and there was really nothing there that you could hang your hat on. And then I may have touched base with him once or twice, John Nemec, along the way, but nothing happened. And then about 5 years ago, before the pandemic, it must have been 2018, I went to a seminar in Florida at, I think it was University of Florida, wherever Erin Kimmelly is. I think she might be at Florida, University of Florida. And she gave a cold case seminar, and I went out there, and they were going to have a talk on a number of things, everywhere from DNA to confessions and how do you tell a suicide from a homicide. It was really an interesting type group. It was only like 30 people. But when the guy got up in the beginning and welcomed everybody, he said, blah, blah, blah. He was Ed Gogan from VDOC, and Aaron's in VDOC too. So I didn't know all that, but he said he was welcoming people, and he happened to mention the Phoenix Canal murders. And of course, my hair caught fire, and I ran after him at the break. And we had never met each other, so we met each other and kind of convened and mind melded on the Phoenix Canal murders. But then he said, have you ever heard of the boy in the box? And I said, of course I have, and I've been in touch with John Nemec. he said, would you consider doing it? I said, yeah, well, sure.
You like a challenge?
Yeah, I like a challenge, 2018, whatever. So anyway, that kind of woke me up again. And then in 2000, I think it was 19.
Right.
They came up, we had a call from the Emmy medical examiner in Philadelphia in the DNA Doe Project. And on that call, we had a couple of calls. And finally, he asked me if I would take the case that they had already tried once to do the DNA microarray, and it really didn't work out. And so he asked me, would I look at it? And I said, sure. Then that started the real push to the end. That was, is this like too long an explanation?
No, this is exactly what we're looking for. And you have this fascinating backstory. We want all of this. This is fantastic.
Yes. So that's when it really started. And I went to the exhumation, April the 25th, 2019, the second exhumation. And I have pictures of that, which I cannot share. But basically, the body was just a bunch of old bones. In 1998, they had redressed him in a little jumper, his remains in a little jumper. He was probably all bones at the time. And it wasn't like awful. I've been to a couple of exhumations, and basically all it is a bunch of bones. And we looked at what remains were available. They had already had some teeth. We took a femur, we took the tailbone, but we already had some teeth, the jaw. And so we reinterred him right after that. The cemetery donated all that. His coffin was actually covered in more of a metal kind of cover that had to be unscrewed and lifted. He was well protected. And so then we went back to the ME's office and looked at the morgue and looked at what was available. There was a bunch of teeth, the bones. They had actually x-rayed the coffin with him in it. What was interesting to me, which I did not know, they had x-rayed his skull and all of that. So what was interesting, which I did not know, is that when a child has his baby teeth coming out, the baby teeth are out. Mm-hmm. Adult teeth are actually loaded already in his jaw. His adult teeth are there. He's arm for bear. It's only when the adult teeth start coming out that the baby teeth drop out. So they had the x-rays with the adult teeth and then the baby teeth under it. And they had x-rayed his head. They x-rayed the whole thing, hoping there was something else that they could find. But it would really, there wasn't. There was just a bunch of old bones.
Now, when you talk about the x-ray, does that mean that the coffin at that point, Joseph's coffin, he was unnamed at that point, it was out of the ground when they did these x-rays?
Yeah, that was in 1998. They x-rayed the whole thing. They x-rayed him. They x-rayed the coffin before they opened it. They x-rayed, and that was like probably the metal. I don't know if the metal thing was over it at the time, but I saw, you could see the nails going in the side of the coffins and the x-ray and stuff like that. So, yeah, it was interesting.
Did they cover it with metal with the idea that they might be able to go back to it one day and get a DNA profile from it? Is that why they covered it with?
I really don't know. That's a really good question. It could have been it could be anything from a procedure that cemetery does to just a tribute. Somebody did some extra money to give a better burial for him, all the way to the city required it. Or I don't think they really thought ahead about getting more DNA out of it. At that time, who would have anticipated the revolution?
At the time of the exhumation, 62 years had gone by since he had been murdered. There's no one on the Philadelphia police force who would have been working the case for that many years. Were any of those detectives from the original case, were any of them still even alive at that point?
Not to my knowledge. The detectives working on it had been, they were the same age as the boy would be now. Detective Bob Hesser and Bill Fleischer, who were the key people. I didn't know Detective Sanamala so much, but they actually became knowledgeable about the case later as they joined the force. And of course, everyone knew this case. So they probably learned about it as young adults, or they knew about it as children maybe in the area, but they became involved as young adults.
But even some of those people might have been in their 60s by that point.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because this whole story.
There's nobody, the original people are gone.
And reading the stories, it just sounds like generations almost of law enforcement officers and medical mm-hmm. examiners and all sorts of people have worked on this case.
Yeah, of course. And it's been a long haul. I'm sure that there's been long periods of time when nothing could be done. And then it would come up again. You would learn something new about something and think about, all right, no, I don't think anybody's left.
So do you know which DNA lab did the work, or are we allowed to have that much information, or are you trying to keep that on the DL?
I tell you, there's several labs that were involved, but okay. The final lab that did it, I really can't disclose. They've asked me because they did it as a favor, or they did it just to see as a part of their experimental. And releasing that information means that every genealogy company is going to start calling them. And,
right.
And they really... they're not, and they have parted company on good terms, saying it's really not their cup of tea.
The reason we ask is because sometimes, as the DNA labs are mentioned, not always though, I noticed we read a dozen or more stories about this exciting development in Joseph's case, but I noticed the DNA lab never came up. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children and Identifinders did, and other people that the VDOC Society. And, of course, the Philadelphia Police Department. But I thought it was curious. There was no mention of who actually did the lab work. Now we understand why.
Yeah, they are okay. They're happy it worked out. But they, like I said, they did a favor, or they did a professional favor out of their own interest, of course, to see if what they could do, if it would work. And it was very enlightening, I think, to the people about what happened, and the fact that we were successful, it's very good. But they asked to remain anonymous because it's not really what they do.
Since you brought up the name, let's go ahead and talk a little bit about the VDOC Society and their involvement with this. So how did they come on board? And it's true, you're a member of the VDOC Society, is that right?
Yes, I am. I'm a full member. I became a member about a year or so ago, which is high honor. I'm very grateful for that. They have really kept the case alive. They have just devoted their own personal resources, their personal interests, their personal support. It was really the Philadelphia Police Department and the Medical Examiner's Office that, you know, Identifinders and whoever this lab is, or whoever, we went to several labs along the way. And that was the real technical effort. They were just very interested and motivated to keep it out there in the public eye. That's their job. That was their job.
How was the DNA profile conveyed to you? And remember, we're civilians here.
Do you mean how is the DNA profile conveyed to me?
Once they had an electronic profile, is that something that can be emailed to you? Or how do they actually transmit the information to say, okay, Identifinders, here's the DNA profile for this unknown young man, murder victim?
Basically, it's just a Dropbox, or it's a WeSend file. It's just an electronic file. It tends to be, can be on the large side if you let it. And the lab did set iterations for us. That we had a discussion because, like I said, they don't do this really. And we had to retrofit what we needed into what they did. So there was a bunch of discussions, but basically it's the same way. All of the files come through email or through Dropbox.
And again, because we're both civilians, and boy, do I wish I'd paid more attention in science class now. When you pull a DNA profile like up on your computer screen, what are you seeing? Are you seeing, I assume you're not seeing a DNA helix like I have on my DNA socks. And I assume you're not seeing columns of numbers. What are you seeing precisely? I wouldn't even know how to interpret it, but try to give me an image, if you will.
Yeah, I can even show you one. The thing is, the raw data is one thing. Then when you put it on GEDmatch or Family Tree, the results are something else.
Sure.
The raw data really has 20 lines of the date and the name, and this is a nice file, we'd like you to use it or whatever. And then it's like every line is, we used a million SNPs or something. So every line is a different SNP. And
this
is what chromosome. It gives the GPS coordinates of the SNP you want, and then it tells you the value of that SNP, what is on the chromosome at that area, that location. And so I can even show you, it's really cut and dry, but they have a million of those. So it's a real long text file.
Very interesting. because I'm still trying to imagine it. And I think it's just going to be one of those things that I'm just going to imagine swirling columns of numbers until I actually...
All it is, it's like a line, just a line of, let me see what it says. Oh, here it is. I found my own 23andMe data. It says the name of the SNP. It says the chromosome it's on, the GPS coordinate of the SNP, where it is along the line there on the chromosome. And then it tells you what it is, AGCT located. And there's a million of those. You have the 1, 2, 3 up to 23 chromosomes. And then you have 22, and then you have the X, and then you have mitochondrial. And if you're a male, you'll have Y SNPs. So you have the whole thing there, all the SNPs that they pick out. So that's what it looks like. I'm sorry I can't show you.
But that's really cool. Because, the writer, filmmaker in me and the person who's obsessed with CSI is sitting there picturing, like, swirling double helixes on a screen. And I know that's not what it is.
It's just cut and dry, bunch of numbers and letters and stuff. And that's all it is. And then you upload that to GEDmatch and it does stuff with it.
Is this work that you then started, or was this part of a IdentiFinders team who began working on this boy in the box challenge?
I did it myself first because I'm the DNA guru on our team. But 2.5 years later, after I figured out how the DNA worked, got the data that we can't show because we can't share screens. Once I had that and we uploaded it to GEDmatch, then our brilliant genetic genealogist, Misty Gillis, went to work and hammered that genealogy into place to get Gus's name to come up.
Where's Misty based out of? Is she in California or elsewhere?
She's located near Chicago.
So you handled it first, and then after 2.5 years, you handed it off to Misty for continued research into family connections and building out family trees?
No, it's all the genealogy. Misty kind of hung in there with me along the DNA. She learned a lot, but really I was the power there trying to find out. It had failed. It failed a couple of times. It failed on microarray. It failed on whole genome sequencing. So we had to get a specialty lab to look at it. So this took 2.5 years. But of course, Misty, I always talked to her about what the next step was and what happened and why. I like it when my team gets educated on what's going on and talking to them, and they come up with ideas sometimes. And then, of course, when the genealogy started, she was taking the lead there. But I was in on it, too, making suggestions and watching what the detectives were asking us and what we should do or asking if we had tried this or that or the other thing. And he was learning from us. So she took the lead after the data came in.
You're listening to Mind Over Murder. We'll be right back after this word from our sponsors. We're back here at Mind Over Murder.
So where were you when you learned we've got the kid's name? Do you recall where you were precisely when you got that news? That's the sort of thing that would have made me jump up and down and scream a little bit. I don't know if you're that kind of person, but I definitely would have been.
I'm sitting right in the chair, right here. Not too bad, the camera. But we had been in touch with the DNA lab, Ryan Gallagher. We had been in touch with Bob Hesser, the detective, and Misty and I. So we had a call. I wish I had written down the date. It was October 2021 when we went over all of the discussion, all the family tree. We had pulled some birth, marriage, death records. May have been in November we convened because we had to pull death records, birth records to fill out the family tree and find out if mom had any other kids and stuff like that. That took months because we were in coming out of COVID. And so finally, I believe it was October, November 2021, we were all on the call going over that. And finally, at the end, he says, okay, we have it. We have it. That was a really nice moment. However, the medical examiner was not on the call. This was in parallel to what the medical examiner does daily on their job. We were just trying to solve the case. Now, or at least get a candidate. So then to work with the medical examiner took several months because first they were changing medical examiners, but also because the medical examiner from the outside, he's going to ask questions like, how do you know dad doesn't have another child that you don't know about? Dad our grandpa doesn't have a child. Maybe there's another brother.
Right.
Dad has a brother, and you don't know about it, and somebody is going to ask whether you covered that base. So you have to go back and work on that, and we did. It took, once the medical examiner had it, that was the last. The medical examiner had to sign off on the death certificate, and that would make it legal. And I think also one of the aspects was that we've had a lot of violent crime, and this is not the only priority of the detectives we work with.
Oh, of course.
So I think all things considered, what's going on in the police department, how shorthanded they are, you know, how hard it is to be a police officer these days, I think they may have held it off just because the powers that be didn't have time or weren't informed yet. And it just took a lot to get everybody on the same page. Let's put it that way. We had him as the candidate in October, November 2021, and we just announced in December 2022.
You mentioned the name of the Philadelphia police detective, and I didn't quite catch it. What's his name again?
Bob Hesser.
Once the ME was on board, and I do get the fact that we're talking about a case that's over 60 years old and the ME isn't just blithely going to take someone's word for it, okay, we've identified this legendary case, without having a lot of questions answered. But once he was on board, the thing is moving forward, the case is moving forward, but slowly because of all the other challenges that Philadelphia is facing. I know Philadelphia has had a very serious problem with murders and other violent crime. Obviously, a 60-plus-year-old cold case is not going to take precedence over something terrible that happened the night before.
Yeah, that's correct. It just took a while. There had to be discussion with the families involved. The boy has half-siblings and siblings, half-siblings on both sides of his family. Some of that had to be discussed with them, and that took time, and that wasn't something you did every day. You returned to that when you had a moment. We were breaking out in hives almost. When are you going to announce this? You just can't tell me to come tomorrow. You have to give some time. And when am I available? When is Misty available? We have to coordinate this. So it was really a question of patience for the last year.
That's going to be hard to have all of this great information there and you just have to sit on it. I can't imagine. I would have wanted to burst with it.
Yeah, the thing is, too, it was tough to do that, but it was also tough for a couple of other reasons. It was funny, about a year ago, I think it was the police, like vice commissioner or something, or the sheriff came up on, he did a news spot on the boy in the box about the time of the anniversary. And then he was buried. The police officer, I believe it was the sheriff or the commissioner, said, there's going to be a breakthrough by the end of the year. I always have gotten emails or messages from people and the public saying, oh my God, just tell me, is he Croatian? Is he Irish? My uncle's Irish. I'm pretty sure that was my uncle's brother or my uncle's nephew or something, or my uncle's brother. Can you please at least tell me if he's Irish? And I usually say no. Then when this announcement came out, that's going to be a breakthrough, I had people writing me like, oh my God, is it really? You're going to make an announcement? You've identified him. And we had to sit on it. So what I did was, one of my close friends wrote, and she said, is it the boy in the box? Are you going to announce it? And I said, no, he made a mistake. I think he meant the girl in the box. And I said, do you know anything about the girl in the box? Anything about that case? And the friend said, no, I don't know. I had never heard about it. I said, okay, then. And she let it go. I thought that was a little bit clever right at the right moment.
I do remember it made news when the senior officer said what he said about the fact that it's going to be significant news in the case.
Yeah. You play telephone even within the police department. And somehow everybody knew it was solved. I don't know how. We were really tight-lipped, and it's probably because the detective stepped out the room with his cell phone every time it came up. You're giving somebody a surprise birthday party, and every time they walk in the room, you have to go in the next room because you don't want them something. And there's even one of the members of the VDOC Society told me that after this phone call that we all decided we had it, we had to present it to the medical examiner. He got a call. He was in Europe traveling, and in the middle of the night, somebody called him and said that we had the identification made. And out of the blue, he's in Europe, and somebody calls him in the middle of the night. So then he said a couple of weeks ago, same guy, same person, he will not identify. It's Russian spies and deep throat and all this stuff going on. I'm going, okay, I don't care.
What do we know about Joseph Augustus Sirelli? I heard you call him Gus earlier. I think that's sweet. What do we know about him now?
Not too much. We haven't released the name of the family, last name Zarelli, so there's not that many. The Facebook group is going wild with that name. We don't know too much except that it's an open homicide and the boy was badly abused. And we also know none of the theories was right. None of them, which is interesting. A woman wrote me maybe a month ago, and she said, I wrote a book on the boy in the box, and here's a picture of who I think it is compared to the boy. And she says, I'm absolutely sure that's him. And I know she was waiting for me to jump through email saying, oh my God, how'd you figure it out? That's wonderful. But she was wrong. She was dead wrong. So all I said was, listen, thanks. I appreciate you keeping this story alive.
But all of the theories that were developed over the years, all the way back to 1957, none of them pan out.
Absolutely none.
And some of them seem so close, like very plausible possibilities. One is this foster home that was only a mile and a half from where his body was found. And I know there's the leads from the JCPenney box and the hat, the man's hat that we talked about a few minutes ago. And this woman, Martha, came forward.
Oh, Martha, yeah.
She offered a pretty plausible possibility, although she, unfortunately herself, had mental illness in her background. So that kind of colored law enforcement's perception of what she had to say. Although what she described sounded very plausible.
Something about the baked beans in his stomach.
Yeah.
He had baked beans, and I don't know that part about the baked beans, but the boy was very, Martha's story was interesting because of the baked beans, but because he was clean, his hair was cut, and you would imagine that a child dying covered with vomit, including baked beans, would be cleaned up, and she knew some of that, but it turned out she was wrong. She was weird, and she didn't know what she was talking about, and that was wrong.
By the way, you mentioned Carl Koppelman a few minutes ago, and of course, Carl's done some incredible work, and he's a self-trained artist, and he actually did a facial reconstruction of the boy when he was unknown, and actually, his artistic renderings of victims are so good because, unlike autopsy photos and other things that are just off-putting and hard to grasp what someone would have looked like, he actually introduces life back into what these people might have looked like, and he has them cleaned up with a nice haircut and a 50s style shirt. To the point where you could actually picture, if you had seen that little boy, let's just say at the grocery store or something, Carl's rendering might actually trigger memory as opposed to staring at these awful photographs of this poor boy when he's lying on an autopsy table.
I agree. And that, again, the technology has improved a lot. And the boy was actually photographed, the general picture of the boy was in sitting up, all dressed and in a chair, more like that. But again, that's very primitive compared to what we know today.
Police sounded very confident when this announcement was made about Gus, as you were saying, Joseph Augustus Sirelli, finally having a name. They sounded very confident that they have some strong leads now on what might have happened to him.
He was badly beaten, obviously, and this is an open homicide investigation, and there are sort of some clues to who did it, who did him in. Again, I wish I could tell you more. I can't because it's open homicide. Sure. We are not involved in that. We already know the story and we know who did it. But there's enough clues that you can think about certain candidates rise to the top as opposed to others. The boy was just very badly abused and he probably died just because he was hit in the head. Something. I wish I could tell you more because it is a rich story. And here I'm on this very famous podcast to talk about it. And I keep hitting my head against the please don't tell anybody wall. That is there something else you would like to talk about?
Did you pick up much on the emotion? Several of the retired detectives and active duty detectives talked about how much of a personal connection they felt to this case. I know you were dealing with the Philadelphia detectives mostly long distance and via electronic means, but did you pick up on that? Their sense of how excited they were to finally see a breakthrough in this?
I did, because I was at the exhumation and I met a lot of them there, and I met a lot of the VDOC people there, and they told me that they remember this story, and they would be the same age as the boy right now. And they went around, as I said, giving out those flyers with their families at the grocery stores. It's not something you forget. Somebody your age is murdered, and it's in like your neighborhood, or it's close to your, it's in your town. And it's a situation that never happens. Not only is he murdered, and I'm sure there's child abuse that had been going on just in general. But then when you find a young boy's body somewhere just dumped in the public area that's accessible by the public, that's not something you let go of when you're a kid. When you see that, that's your first exposure to death, your first exposure to death. And not only that, but the murder of somebody who's your own age.
We're seeing here, I think, the same sort of intense emotion that we also saw when the lady in the Dunes case broke a couple of months back. And there were so many people who were so excited and felt so connected to this, the victim of this truly horrible crime. I think it's fantastic that you guys are able to work on these much older cases. Is there, I feel like wish list is maybe a little bit of a gruesome way to put it. Do you have a wish list of other older homicides that you would like to sink your teeth into in order to do this, continue doing this?
Yeah, let me think about that. You must know about the Somerton man.
That was a pretty
good one. Yeah, that one was pretty good because that was based on hair. Let's see, there's a couple. There's one from Deadwood. I worked on Deadwood, South Dakota, was being like renovated. There was a house that was... they were building a retaining wall near the house, and they found a cemetery that was some people still left in the cemetery underneath the house. One of them was a man who's never been identified. I did the Y-DNA on that some time ago. I think I'd like to do that. That's a really cool historical case.
Well, these have to be incredibly challenging. I mean, the work you did on the Somerton man case, which we talked about a while back here on Mind Over Murder, was just absolutely fascinating. Do you feel like you're going to be the go-to person for these historical cases? You've really faced down some pretty serious challenges.
I really hope so. I love international work. I do that pretty well. I've worked with Australia on several cases that have yet to be announced that were very interesting, and they were very international. There's always other cases, the Plaza Woman from Isle Woman. Those are like the same as the Somerton Man that are just out there. And the authorities in those countries really don't want to go anywhere with that right now because they're still getting their toe in the water. I forgot we had talked about the Somerton Man, right?
Yeah.
It was a
fascinating conversation. And
trying to remember everything I've done in the last few months. It's been
you must do a ton of media. Like, what for a case like this? How many interview requests are you fielding? How much media are you actually doing for these sorts of
this particular case? What happens is if you give a interview for, let's say, the Philadelphia Inquirer, it's mirrored all over the place.
Right.
I've really been. This one, Somerton Man, was over the top. We had everybody. This one is actually more social media that's exploding over it, less just regular conventional media. It probably will develop into... See, the problem is, too, is that Somerton Man, we could talk about and talk about. We knew the family. The family has come forward. We could talk about the long history, the piece of paper in the pocket, the hair in the cast and all that. But the problem with the boy right now is we can't really talk too much because he was only 4 years old. He didn't have a history. It's not like he went to college and then they found his body and they investigated all his roommates and stuff like that. He was a boy, probably pretty like... if there's a four-year-old child living two blocks from me, I'm not going to know it because I don't have children myself. So he's a lot more obscure, and the fact it's an open homicide is hard to speak about. It's very frustrating because there are some very interesting things I could tell you about that, but I don't want to interfere with the investigation.
That's understandable.
And I don't want to make it sound like we're criticizing the Zarelli family either. I know they said specifically that the mother and the father of this boy are dead, but that he does have siblings or half siblings, but they haven't necessarily come forward. And I understand that they might prefer to remain in the background. It's another avenue where if someone like a brother or a sister or someone like that came forward and began talking about Joseph Augustus Sorelli as little kid, would paint more of a complete picture. Perhaps that will happen down the road if an offender is ever identified.
Yeah, I doubt that because he's younger than all of these half-siblings that are still used. And I think there's another half-sister who was adopted out who never met him. He didn't know anything about him. So there's nobody really that can speak about it. There's really nobody. There's maybe an uncle here or one of the sides. He may not know anything either. It's so far in the past. Like I say, Somerton man, he was an adult. He had his divorce decree. He was married. He had brothers, sisters. They all grew up in the same house. You have family pictures. But in this case, the boy is four. And the parents are dead. So if there were any family pictures, and why would you take family pictures? And you could, like Gabriel Fernandez or whatever. But you know that back then, there's just so little about him, known about him. And being four, he's not even in school yet.
Where he would have met his peers, right. Hopefully.
Right. He would have met, there would have been school records. Or there would have been, he was originally thought to be maybe as old as seven.
Right.
But in that case, maybe that somebody in second grade would know him, or first grade. He was four. He didn't even go to school, so he's probably at home a lot.
And some of the theories, which I know have been put aside, seem to have a through line that there was a possibility that he was adopted and then abused by adoptive or foster parents.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think that's correct. I think he stayed with his parents or his at least one of the original parents. I don't think he was really adopted out. I don't think that's right.
I guess the ultimate tragedy is that this happened and he was murdered and obviously missing, and no one ever reported him as such.
Yeah. Again, if you think about my neighborhood here, I have kids running around, or it might be a kid two or three houses over. If the kid doesn't show up, if the kid disappears, I wouldn't even think to ask. If I had my own kids, it would be one thing. And then you look back 50 years, 60 years ago, you can always say, oh, he's off visiting his aunt, or we're considering moving to New York, so I sent him to live with my aunt for a few months. Yeah. There's nothing, and there's no record of him except his birth certificate. Other than that, there's no school record. I'm not sure you could get a baptismal record. We didn't try that.
Oh, my. We are so glad, though, that he has a name, and it's down to the fantastic work that you and your team did, that this poor little boy now actually has a name and someone can actually put it on a stone for him. So what is up next for your team? Can you tell us, or do you have to keep it on the DL like normal?
Well, I tell you, we have some really cool cases we're working on, and you really can't talk about some of them. One of them I will talk about that I'm very interested in is we're doing Madison Jane Doe. She is a little girl that was found in a suitcase in 2015 or 16 in Texas. And she had a feeding tube in the suitcase with her. And she was discarded by the side of the road in some rural area of Texas. And we're doing a really bang-up job. We've been working on it, I think, three or four years now. And it's not as prominent as Boy in the Box, but the little girl is just, it's so interesting because the DNA says she's got Mexican, she's got old California Spanish, she's got French Canadian, and she's got Central American, Guatemalan, and El Salvadorian. What's interesting, we've made contact with the forensic people in Guatemala and El Salvador, and they're helping us. We have her teeth being analyzed for the isotope analysis, and that will tell you where you grew up.
Oh, wow.
The isotopes in your teeth, because everything you eat and drink, breathe, becomes part of you in some sense. So when you are a baby and your teeth are forming, everything you eat and drink becomes part of the enamel. And that never changes. That's the one part of the body that never changes.
Oh, wow.
So having her to find out where she was born, see if she was born in Central America or here. And I love that because your body is like a book on who you are, where you're coming from. And we're just turning one page after another for the book.
Do you think you'll be able to identify Madison Jane Doe?
Yeah, I think so. We're going to keep trying. The databases are not great for Mexican Central Americans necessarily. So there's some distant matches, and the forensic people in El Salvador, we've turned over to them some candidates for cousins and relatives and great uncles and stuff. They're going to do some work for us, trying to find those families and discuss with them, help find out. That is one case that we really are very interested in, and just taking a long time because of the ethnic background. That's one. We're working on another Don Doe called Altoona Lake, and that's a man in the lake in Georgia, in Altoona, Georgia, who was shot, but at the same time, he had swim fins on in the lake with rocks in his pockets. So you have to think, what happened there? Is it murder? Is it suicide? It's so weird.
Yeah, what a mystery.
And that one's carrying on for a long time because we had some problems with the samples, but I think we have them worked out now.
Colleen, as always, thank you for taking the time to talk to the two of us about the amazing work you're doing. And please just keep right on doing it. And as long as you keep breaking cases, we'll have you right back on the podcast.
Okay, it's a deal. Sounds like a plan.
Thank you so much for joining us on this episode of Mind Over Murder. We'll see you next time.
Mind Over Murder is a production of Absolute Zero and Another Dog Productions.
Our executive producers are Bill Thomas and Kristen Dilley.
Our logo art is by Pamela Arnois.
Our theme music is by Kevin McLeod.
Mind Over Murder is distributed in partnership with Crawl Space Media.
You can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram.
You can also follow our page on the Colonial Parkway Murders on Facebook.
And finally, you can follow Bill Thomas on Twitter at BillThomas56.
Thank you for listening to Mind Over Murder.